This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Wendell Castle on March 27th, 2014. And we're at Wendell's studio in Scottsville, New York. Wendell, thank you very much for agreeing to meet with us today and conduct this interview. We're really excited to have you as part of the Living Legacy Project.
Glad to do it.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah, this is, it's really incredible having, you know, an artist with the diversity of your career so close to us in Western New York, you know, just sort of over near Rochester, and having received a recent award from the Smithsonian for Lifetime in the Arts?
Right? I don't know exactly. Yeah. Smithsonian, what do they call it? Lifetime Achievement or something like that.
Mm-hmm, the inaugural award for the Visionary Award.
Oh, okay.
That you received. So, how long have you been a practicing artist, could you even say?
Well, I don't think you can count college as being a practicing artist. Mm-hmm. But shortly after, I think, that I began to try to be a practicing artist. My undergraduate was degree in industrial design. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really want to be an industrial designer, although it's turned out to be that education was very helpful. Mm-hmm. I really thought painting or sculpture was what I wanted to do. And sculpture I like the best because it's real, you're working with real things. And so I got a master's in sculpture at the University of Kansas. And the University of Kansas was the first university to have a really professional bronze casting facility. So that was kind of what I did mostly in college, was bronze casting stuff. Although I did a little bit of carving, a little bit of stonework, a little bit of welding. Mm-hmm. We do a little bit of everything. So as soon as I finished, I moved to New York City and looking to, you know, be an artist. And at that point, I really wasn't thinking about furniture. I was thinking about sculpture. And, you know, visited galleries and talked to galleries and not much happened. And I hadn't been there much over a year, and out of the blue came a job offer when I wasn't even looking for a job at the dean of the Rochester Institute of Technology Art Department had seen a piece of mine, which I'd actually made in college, that was exhibited in New York, and he thought it looked like an interesting direction, and I guess he'd thought that their furniture design program was stagnant, mm-hmm. and that painting a sculptor in might be a good idea. Well, I wasn't really interested in taking a furniture design job, but I really was struggling in New York and not selling anything. And money was short, and my studio didn't amount to much. And they would supply me here a studio to work in and have access to the machinery. So I thought, well, I can go up there for a year or two, get my feet on the ground, get a better portfolio, come back to New York. And the first year I was here, I did just make sculpture, which was 62. And then the second year, I began to get more interested in furniture. And then I had also seen that there was a field out there. I didn't know there was really a field. I had heard of and seen pictures of Wharton Esherick's work. But that was about the extent of what I knew about what was going on. And being here in that furniture design program, I began to find out that there was a real field out there, which was pretty primitive at the time. And mm-hmm. I didn't think anything very interesting was happening. And I thought, well, here's a field wide open. I can jump right in and be at the top. Mm-hmm. And I did, and I was. I mean, right off from, by 1964, I'd had a music stand of mine displayed at the Triennale in Italy, and it got a huge amount of press. It was in Time magazine and all kinds of other magazines. Mm-hmm. And so I got some, after working in the field 1 year, I began to get a lot of notoriety. And it was partly because my vocabulary was different. Mm-hmm. The music stack maybe wasn't as different as the stack laminated pieces, mm-hmm. which I worked a little bit with the bentwood things that was the vocabulary of the music stand, But I didn't see a real future in that vocabulary. I made some few nice pieces, and Music Stand is maybe the best. But anyway, what happened, there seemed to be more of a future, and I felt, at least I felt there was, in by laminating and stacking the wood and carving.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was more like sculpture to mm-hmm. me.
I had read that you first found out about that process in like a DIY book of your father's.
Well, that's I think kind of a cute story. My father was a bit of a handyman. He didn't really make anything much, but there was always some tools around the house, and he subscribed to a little magazine, which I actually have, called Deltagram, which was published by the Delta Machinery Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very thin little magazine. I think it cost 10 cents. And was full of how-to-do things. And one of the how-to-do articles was how to make a duck decoy. And the duck decoy, they showed that you could just go to the lumber yard and buy some 3/4-inch white pine. And they gave you the patterns of slicing the duck every 3/4 of an inch. And you could lay the patterns on the wood and saw it out with your coping saw, glue it all together, take a rasp, knock off the stair steps, and you'd have a duck, which I thought was pretty cool, but I never made a duck, and why, I don't know. But then when I was in college studying sculpture, I remember a magazine, I don't remember what the name of the magazine was, that was doing an article on Leonard Baskin,
mm-hmm.
and Leonard Baskin made a lot of wood carvings, and he didn't work from logs. He had blocks of I think usually mahogany, glued up at a mill workhouse, and it showed his process. Or he had the mill workhouse glue up this huge block. It must have been like 3 foot by 3 foot by 7 or 8 feet, just big rectangle. And then he goes to work and carves a figure out of it. And I thought to myself, if he'd only read the article about the duck, he could have saved himself a ton of wood and a ton of time, because the lamination would be close to his final form, a lot less carving. And of course, the more I thought about it, there's a lot more advantage than that because you can do things like cantilever and hollow and solid, and you can work with balance and defying of gravity. There's all kinds of things you can do because you're laminating it. You can have a hollow if you want. And so that was in college. But I really, even though I wanted to do it, we didn't have any real facility to do it. And I tried it, but it was crude.
Mm-hmm.
And I did make some pieces that were kind of laminated without a planer, without a jointer, and some basic woodworking things. Really couldn't make it work. But then when I came to Rochester, they had all those tools I needed. So then I was able to do it. And that vocabulary, or the possibilities of that vocabulary, were terrific. Things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still doing it.
Yeah, still
influences. There were breaks, however, where I didn't do it.
Can you talk a little bit about the different transitions in your career where you did both, you know, work with laminate and then move away from that, and all the different mediums that you work in as well, you know, your relationship with petro-based chemicals and materials like that, as well as wood and casting and metals and...
Well, I didn't really want to be categorized as a woodworker
mm-hmm.
or a person that worked in wood. So I really wanted to do other things. And, of course, what I really wanted to do early on was cast things in bronze, but I couldn't afford it. That's expensive. So that was out. So plastic seemed to be the next best option for soft organic forms. And so I began to experiment with that by around 1966. And the first things I did, well, I also wanted to not have everything brown. Either. Another reason, I wanted to introduce color into things. And so I began to try to, at first, apply paint to some wooden pieces, which was not very good. But then I needed to seal the surface in some much better way. So I actually fiberglassed over wood for some pieces. And I mean, that the results weren't bad, but that's a long way around in doing things. So then the idea what came to me that I needed to cast them so that they were all fiberglass and they would be much lighter and they would be very durable. And I did make a number of one-off fiberglass pieces, but then I really began to think that maybe working one-off was not the really way to work with that material, that molds can be reused many times if they're properly made. You could make large additions of things. In fact, they weren't actually additions, they were kind of open additions. And the molar chair was one of the first ones that got some success. And I worked with the idea that I wanted to keep it really simple so that there was not a lot of work, or hopefully no work, after it was pulled out of the mold. It would come out of the mold and it would be finished. There'd be nothing to do. Well, the molar chair does that. Out of the mold, nothing to do. Just put the little rubber molding around the bottom and you got it. And some of the tables were almost as simple, where there'd be a top piece and a bottom piece. So assembly was super easy. And that was the basis for a large part of the vocabulary. And I actually found a good distribution for the molar chair and castle chair and a bunch of other things with two New York City dealers who were, number one was the molar was handled by George Bellarion. And George Bellarion had his own furniture company in the late 60s, early 70s. And he was the first American importer of the Cartel line, and plus a lot of other, almost all Italian. And the other person I dealt with was Charlie Stendig. And Charlie Stendig had a really avant-garde line, and he was mostly Italian in the things that he sold, but he took on a couple of pieces of mine. Neither one of them lasted very long. That they both were bought out. Let's see, George, I think George was bought out by Steelcase, and they made him then in charge of their design program. And Charlie Stendig was bought out by Burlington, and he just retired. So after about a year in production, they weren't in production anymore because those other companies had a different idea about things, and they didn't want anything that only sold about 50 or 60 a year. They wanted to sell 50 or 60 a day, I think. And so they dropped them. And then I had a good relationship with the factory. I tried to sort of keep it going, but I could see that the only way that was going to work was going to take way too much of my time. I didn't want to do that, so just dropped the whole thing.
And so you dropped that sort of slightly more mass production line, but in some ways you've kept coming back to fiberglass in different ways. And
we have some fiberglass pieces. Well, there's a very simple one back there being worked on now, but some of them are more complex. But I've taken a different approach. Since I'm going to be able to sell them for a great deal more money, I can afford to put more money into it. That the molar originally sold for $150, and I can't remember what it cost me, but it must have been, you know, less than half of that. So almost nothing. It was so cheap. Nowadays, fiberglass is not cheap anymore, but I can also charge a whole lot more for my furniture than I used to. So I began to abandon the idea that I had to pull it out of the mold finished. And so now we have more complex pieces, which means the molds are complex, which means that you have to assemble parts, which then means that you have some work to do on the pieces. But, you know, there's a few samples sitting right out there.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to do that. The problem with the fiberglass, the recent fiberglass, is that even the toughest paints, epoxy or urethane, are not as tough as the gel coat of the original plastic. And so they scratch too easily. So we began to gold leaf them and silver leaf them. And we do a kind of an antique version of both. And so they look a little distressed from the beginning. So if they do get somewhat distressed, you don't even notice it. And that's worked very well. Those are working well.
I wanted to kind of ask about how you both create these works that are wholly different or wholly unique in appearance from the materials that makes them up in some ways, but in other ways there's such an awareness of organic form and the underlying materials. And you really play with this tension in your different works. And even having this sort of patina that shows sort of the distressed quality of these very amorphous things. I'm wondering if you could just talk about how you perceive your relationship to each object. You know, like, are you trying to create something, when, and the differences between when you're trying to create something shiny and, you know, completely unlike the materials that it's made of versus when you want to show the process through or the materials within.
I mean, so much of that is kind of automatic. But when I'm drawing and sketching and trying to create ideas, I'm not thinking about a material. I think about it a little later, and then you think about it, then you begin to think about it differently. Mm-hmm. And what might send you in a certain direction is this piece has certain things happening in it that would be more appropriate to plastic than it would be to wood. And on wood pieces, you have to always worry about, can you get your tools in here? With plastic, you don't have to worry too much about that, because you're working with a different material that's so easy to work with, like foam, that really isn't particularly a difficulty. So that would be different. And then also think about what would be shiny and what would be dull and what would be smooth and what would be textured. Now, texture is really a complex subject, because there are all levels of texture. And we don't do too many different textures, although I'd like to do more with that. We lead this the tool mark, and the tool that shapes these things to their final shape is a Stanley Sureform, which is kind of a cheese grater looking thing, and it leaves a certain kind of texture, and you can organize that texture in a way that, so you get an organized texture. Or you can chip the whole thing with a chisel, and you have, again, another natural thing that's going on. It's not foreign to that at all. It chiseled the whole thing, although that can have complications. Again, can you get the chisel in there? And it takes a good bit of skill to do that. But that's a good one, and we continue to do that one. And I've wanted to even get rougher, but I'm finding it hard to do, to find that middle ground between being too rough and being too refined. We almost never sand completely a piece anymore. We used to sand pieces so they would be smooth all over. We don't hardly ever do that. We sand inside the seat because the contact there with your body is probably going to be better. And for bronze pieces, there's a different attitude yet, that really that can be almost nothing matters. You can do probably anything. And you have new ways of introducing texture. You could put wax all over it, hot wax, and texture that. You could put plaster over the... Typically, they would put plaster over an armature. I put plaster over foam, which is, I think, a nicer way to work than having the old-fashioned armature. And I'm actually looking for more ways to do that, to find some other material that I might apply. Now, plaster is kind of a nuisance to work with. You have to keep the plaster wet the whole time, or the next plaster you put on won't adhere. And it's difficult on big pieces to keep them wet.
And to keep it of the right consistency, maybe, to retain the texture.
Well, no, the plaster, the consistency isn't a problem. So that but just, I don't know, that's a difficult one. And the result is good, but the working with it, there are little problems.
Looking at, when you're talking about texture, I was thinking of your environmental series from the early 1990s. I was looking at the catalog for it the other day with sort of the different lamps, but also some of the more, and maybe this was two different series, the environmental series and then also the art tables that you were making in the early 90s. And you seemed to, texture was very important in those series as well. Can you talk a little bit about how you, do you or don't you reflect on your earlier stages when you're innovating for a new place with where you are now?
Well, I'm sure you do. I mean, with those, I think you're talking about what I call the star tables, because they were a little starfish looking.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked with a different wood that textured differently.
Uh-huh.
And it was a softish wood. So you could do a lot more with the texture than you can with the really hard woods. And then, because we painted them, mm-hmm. which allowed us to then saturate the wood with epoxy, which hardened the surface,
mm-hmm.
and then apply color on it. So that got around the fact that it was soft wood. But with the kind of vocabulary I'm working with now, I want the wood to be more visible. I want to be able to see grain, and I want to be able to see the lamination. So painting is kind of out.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't seem right to paint them. So that what you end up with is, you know, we left an awful lot of the chainsaw marks in those star tables and some of the angel chairs, because you could, that wood was soft enough that you could control that. And there's, the vocabulary was such that there was less end grain.
Mm-hmm.
End grain affects how you work with the material, because it is so hard. But the soft wood, like we were using, you could still get your chainsaw marks in the end grain. But now we're taking the attitude that we really want to make it out of a really hard wood,
because
mm-hmm. we don't want the seats scratching with people sitting in them, and mostly what we make are chairs. So we have to have a hard wood. And that means when you saw the end grain with the chainsaw, it really does not carve smoothly at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that texture is kind of becomes uncontrollable on really hardwood pieces. So you're dealing with so many little things that affect how you make things. And that's one of the nice things about making things out of bronze, that pretty much all these concerns go away.
Mm-hmm. But you have developed all these different, as you say, vocabularies for how to work with all these different materials and forms. Do your vocabularies overlap, or are they specific? Like with bronze, maybe it's a specific vocabulary.
No, they overlap.
Yeah.
They overlap.
Yeah.
That bronze because you're making a model and it's forgiving. If you take off too much wood in a wooden piece, it's ruined. If you take off too much on a piece that's going to be cast bronze, you can add back. I mean, plaster, working with plaster, is both adding and subtracting. You can do both. With wood, you can't add anymore once you've got it laminated and carved. That's it. You've got to get it right. So, for whatever that means, I certainly don't want to ever, like, get into just one material. I really like it that the fact that there's some plastic going on, there's quite a bit of wood going on, and there'll be a lot more bronze going on in the next 6 months or more, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all good, because then it gives you all this, you don't get stuck in a rut, I think, because you're thinking about so many different things, that they all kind of rub off on each other.
And that does seem to be one of the defining components of your career, that you are very difficult to pin down in any one avenue, because you are so often blurring these lines both between form and function and, you know, materials that are used and even color schemes and vocabularies in that way. And I think the sort of innovation seems to be the one thing that you do as a constant.
Well, I think that you're right. I feel that way. But I think it's also that I really never really satisfied with what I'm doing. And so you always have to kind of reach out a little further and try a little harder. And I think one of the things that has helped put me in the good position that I am now is that I did those fiberglass things. I think that if you looked back at my career, there's a number of the things that I've done that were, in a sense, blind alleys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the trompe l'oeil work, for example, I would now call a blind alley,
mm-hmm.
but for very odd reasons. I mean, I really felt when I began to make furniture instead of sculpture, and the reason I felt fine with that is I thought, why can't sculpture I mean, why can't furniture be just as sculptural as sculpture? And why can't it have all the vocabulary? What, not much difference. And so that was kind of my goal, try to raise the level of what people might think furniture could be and raise it to a level equal to sculpture. Well, I began to question that a bit in the 70s, mm-hmm. and thought, I thought that when I began to make the furniture that I used a vocabulary that certainly would be considered sculpture, kind of that soft organic vocabulary of Brancusi and Arp and Moore and people like that. But then I began to think, well, maybe that's not right. Maybe the opposite of that would be better, and not design the furniture at all. They've just copied things, but use something that makes it special. And I certainly knew about Trompe l'oeil, and I don't think I knew a lot about Trompe l'oeil carving particularly, but I knew that about Trompe l'oeil. And that Trompe l'oeil has always been considered art. So if I did it Trompe l'oeil, why wouldn't it be art? Well, I was exactly right. It was. It was considered art. And so it was very successful. But it wasn't any fun to do. It was very exciting in the beginning because it's a challenge. And you don't know. I had practice in a different way. I did a lot of portrait sculpture in college, so I could do accurate stuff like that. So there's no reason I couldn't translate that to carving, mm-hmm. which didn't turn out to be difficult at all. And I thought it would be very difficult to, say, carve an overcoat that would look so real somebody thought it was an overcoat. Well, that didn't turn out to be so hard to do. And the idea that you would put this with a piece of furniture in a normal way, the coat could hang on a coat rack, throw over the back of a chair, things that you would normally do, an umbrella stand in an umbrella stand. All these are normal things that no one would question that these two things go together. So it really really what I learned from it was about seeing, and how sloppy people generally are about seeing things. Because if you see something that you're familiar with, you don't have to study it very carefully at all. That you know in this millisecond exactly what you're looking at. So it's easy to fool you. Mm-hmm. So it was the fact that the garment was in a normal place, or it would naturally be. Everything was fine in the picture. The fact that it was the wrong color didn't seem to bother anybody. So it was successful, and they sold well. But after the sort of fact that you could do it, then I didn't want to do it anymore, because I knew I could do it. It's much more fun to think things that are really challenging and you're not sure whether you can do it or not. Mm-hmm. That's much more interesting. And the other thing that the Trompe l'oeil left out that I enjoy so much was the drawing, trying to figure out form. Well, I drew Trompe l'oeil pieces, but it was a different kind of drawing. It was more like still life drawing. And that was not challenging the way it is to try to discover what, you know, this and then that and then this, which is much more fun to do, mm-hmm. and create those risks that seem to be important. So if it's easy to do and you know it's going to be successful, then there's no reason to do it. And so
that seems to be the basis of much of your career. You know, once you really explore something, then you want to go on and try something else.
Yeah, because I don't really want to be repeating myself and mm-hmm. doing the same thing. So you want to find a vocabulary that offers lots of possibilities, and I think I'm doing pretty well with the one I'm doing right now. It seems to offer lots of possibilities of different ways to do it in different materials, and I don't know how long that will last, but mm-hmm. It would seem to have some depth.
In some ways you're credited as being one of the founders of the art furniture movement, and sort of what you were just saying about, you know, using your work and your techniques to subvert the way people see things and the line between, you know, art and craft. Have you viewed your role as intentionally subversive through different stages of your career, you know, when you are trying to deconstruct these false dualities?
Mm-hmm. I mean, early on, when I was doing this stack laminated things in the 60s, mm-hmm. other furniture makers, the well-known ones, were critical of what I did. The general public really didn't know much about how you made things anyway, so they weren't concerned, but it was people like Wharton Esherick, George Nakashima, Sam Maloof were very critical. Sam Maloof sort of stopped being critical after a little while. The others didn't. And thought this was just not the way you work with wood. This is improper way to do it. You know, you're not respecting the wood. It's hugely wasteful. And I remember I gave a lecture in the 70s at the Royal College of Art in London, and how the students really didn't respond well at all to my work. They thought that this is crazy. You're wasting all this wood. You should be able to make 10 pieces out of the wood that you used to make that one piece. They were very concerned about that. And people like George Nakashima thinks he should have a natural respect for the grain of the wood, and the grain of the wood tells you how you're going to make the piece. Mm-hmm. And I pay no attention to that at all. But that sort of all went away after a while. And well, now I've probably introduced another one that will probably have some people saying, I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be using a robot. That's not the right way to make art. Although there are a lot of artists using a robot.
There are a lot of artists, too.
There are a lot. And probably more and more every day. So it's not a legitimate criticism. And I don't think it was a legitimate criticism ever to say, well, you shouldn't use that much valuable material in making just one piece. Mm-hmm. Well, a sculptor would never worry about that. And would anybody criticize Brancusi? You use too much wood? No, you wouldn't. It's a stupid attitude, and it has to do with traditional thinking about how furniture is made.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you know, because you've always sort of like walked this line and blurred this line between art and furniture. Would you say that you got more pushback from the fine art community or from the furniture community?
Well, I didn't fit comfortable in either one. I mean, even now that, you know, that there are some books that come out that are on furniture, but more furniture from the sort of craft standpoint. Mm-hmm. And there's several books that have come out, and I'm not in there. Mm-hmm. They're supposedly showing all the top work. But they just, you know, I don't know. I certainly don't mind it now. Mm-hmm. I used to think that was a problem. But I think it's a good thing, actually. I'm obviously doing something they're not comfortable with. And I think, what was it? Some book came out like Furniture with Heart or something, which is pretty wide open. Now I'm not in there.
You clearly have a lot of heart, so that was...
But I get in plenty. I can't complain.
Yeah.
I get in plenty of books. Mm-hmm. So... that's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of still a prejudice in a way. And I mean, there's a field that's referred to as studio furniture, which is a very different field. I don't like to have my work considered studio furniture. I think they have a different approach and different respect for things.
And that's interesting, because I have seen you connected with that.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what the studio furniture movement was or is, and where you don't feel that you fit into that?
Well, there is now what is considered design as art, furniture as art, mm-hmm. not art furniture, mm-hmm. furniture as art or design as art. There is a kind of a definition now. I don't think that too many people would agree on the exact same definition, but that I get put in a category with Ron A. Rod, mm-hmm. and Zaha Hadid and Mattia Bonetti, and mostly European. That couple of years ago, when in press for Design Miami, they named the top 10 designers in the world, and I was the only American on that list. So there is a kind of a definition, mm-hmm. of a field. And one of the things that's very different about that group of people and this other group of people from the Furniture Society, or whose work is generally categorized as studio furniture, if you look at why it's made and who it's made by, how it's exhibited, how it's sold, how much it sells for, it's entirely different. That I think it's that one of the things that benefits work is to be very careful about where it is exhibited and in what context it's exhibited. Mm-hmm. That I certainly don't want my work in, say, the architectural design, or what's that architecture? Well, what's the name of that show? I guess, well, anyway, regular furniture show, I don't want to be in. And that if you can get your work exhibited at a very prestigious places, and you can build a history of the fact that your work has always increased in value over the years, then you can just put it in a different place. And I don't think any of the studio furniture makes that those jumps. Mm-hmm. They don't get exhibited in the right place. They don't sell for enough money. Things like that. That, you know, a New York City gallery, a good one, really isn't going to want to deal with anybody unless they're going to be able to sell works that have some real, pretty decent prices.
Yeah.
Well, you know, or they just, why bother?
Yeah.
You know, and so if you can make those jumps, and not that I've been so smart about it,
mm-hmm.
because I don't think I was smart at all, but I kind of managed to fumble through,
mm-hmm.
that early on, I pretty much went into any show that would take me. Now I don't do that anymore. I turn down a lot of shows because I don't think I want to be in that context. And it's wonderful to get into that position because then that makes your work even more special.
Right. Especially within the eyes of the arts, art capitalism, essentially, you know, thinking about how you have to play that game as well to be perceived a certain way.
I mean, I've been doing this pretty much as long as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think in making the art part of this, the furniture as art, I may have been the earliest
mm-hmm.
of anybody. Not that I got so much attention for it then.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm going to have a one-man show at the Museum of Art and Design in New York. And what the show's going to be, it's going to be Wendell Castle Remastered. And the exhibition is going to be some of the most important pieces I made in the 60s. And then, if it's a chair I made in the 60s, then a chair that I made recently, and or a dining table I made in the 60s, and a dining table I made recently. So it's half old pieces and half brand new pieces.
That sounds incredibly
where
exciting.
Where the robot will play a part. I think it'll be interesting.
I think especially for your work and your career, given that, you know, you are never static, you know, you are never working in one avenue maybe that long, being able to have that juxtaposition in one place be especially, and not just that one juxtaposition, all those juxtapositions in one place would be incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I just was in New York just a couple of days ago,
mm-hmm.
and they have an interesting show at the Museum of Art and Design right now,
mm-hmm.
a show about sort of what artists are using, how they're using the digital technology available,
mm-hmm.
you know, 3D printed pieces.
That's a good precursor and for
so that
your
they
work.
They've gotten this show's been very successful. They've had good turnout,
mm-hmm.
and there's a nice catalog. So that's good.
That's very good, and yeah, very good for what you're going to be presenting with the robot and that sort of thing. So if we could talk a little bit about your studio environment and how you both, you know, foster a large studio to create your works, and now the integration of more technology and large-scale robotics into how you create what you create. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the introducing of the digital things that we do began like maybe a little over 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then making models
mm-hmm.
so that could be scanned and then patterns could be printed. Now what that does, as opposed to how I did it in the 60s, I did plan cross sections and did plan patterns, but I had to just plan them in my mind. And so you that which limited you to some extent on what you might do,
mm-hmm.
because there would be a certain point where you just couldn't figure that one out.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I never thought that was a disadvantage, because it never occurred to me there was any other way, but once this way was available, you could open up this vocabulary to a lot more complexity that you could never, like in this one, to figure out what a cross section right here might be. Would go through the tip of this, through the tip of that,
mm-hmm.
through the tip of that, and one hanging out here. You could never figure that out. That would be impossible. You would be back to the Leonard Baskin way of working. You could only just build a great big old block and start carving, which would be absurd. But I knew that once you scanned and once you put that in the computer, a computer can easily slice that mm-hmm. any way you want, mm-hmm. even some crazy angle if you want it. Not a problem. But then also, once you put it in the computer, you could change something. You know, if I made this model and I decided maybe the seat back should be higher, mm-hmm. I'd have to make a whole new model, which is like 2 days of work. Well, on the computer, it's about 2 minutes work. Just pull this back up a little higher. Or maybe the seat's not deep enough. You can pull it out, push it back. You can make some adjustments. And so that was what we did first. That was just it. But then the next natural thing to do is that we began to send out pieces to a robot. And we had to make a little more careful patterns and had to be a little more careful about your laminating. But that worked well. And we sent out to a robot who carved things for us. But I really wanted to have a robot, my own robot, so I could play with it. It's too expensive to play with somebody else's. In fact, it was an hour drive away. And try these little things that we could do. I mean, I thought about the possibility is if you took these kind of bullet mm-hmm. shapes, which I think of as kind of ellipsoids, but sometimes a little pointy for an ellipsoid. If you took like 50 of those and created them in the computer, all different sizes, and you just mushed them together in a lump. Not mushed so much that there would be no voids, just mushed. Mm-hmm. They could slice off the bottom so it'd have a flat spot. Mm-hmm. And you could take and dig out a seat, like take an ice cream scoop and just dig out a seat, and you would expose all these voids and all these tunnels. It'd be crazy.
You can't even...
We can do that. Well, we're not there yet. We're not there, because that would be... we're still learning, but there's no reason you can't do that. And also, we're making bigger things mm-hmm. now, and breaking them into parts makes sense. And the computer and the robot will be very helpful in breaking things into parts. Mm-hmm. And then just take some of the drudgery out of things. With the chair I showed you, where we're going to be making 18 chairs, mm-hmm. two different sizes actually. But, you know, after about two or three of those, you're kind of getting sick of that one. And it does a much better, more accurate job, mm-hmm. particularly in making one that's like another, which theoretically additions should be fairly close to mm-hmm. being like each other. And, you know, there's just many, many, many things. I could go on and on about things that are possible and we might get to do, but, you know, we're taking little steps, but mm-hmm. making this big chair, they're working really well.
You have set a precedent for this in some ways, even with the development of the Wendell Castle School in the 80s, possibly.
Well, as a precedent for...
As a precedent for both sort of the creation of artwork outside of the individual artist, you know, the need for a workshop, the need for many hands or many different abilities, whether it's robotic or...
Well, I don't think robotic even entered into a conversation then.
Not at all.
It was too early for that. The school was an interesting thing to do and exciting for a while. I mean, in some way, I followed a lead of John Makepeace, who mm-hmm. had started his school before mine. And the results that he was getting were terrific. And I didn't see any school in this country that got that kind of results in a short amount of time. It was a 2-year program. Mm-hmm. And they got more in 2 years than, say, most of the 4-year programs were mm-hmm. getting. And so I established something along those lines, mm-hmm. which was successful. But the problem became it took too much of my time. And the other part of it was that, I mean, it was a not-for-profit organization, but we still had to rate. This tuition did not cover everything. Mm-hmm. And I found it pretty easy to do fundraising in the beginning. I hit up my friends. Well, you can't keep going back to the same people.
Right.
So I could see after a couple of years of this that there's a potential problem here.
Right.
That I don't want to become a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And RIT had been after us to have our program join theirs. And so I accepted their offer.
So the school is sort of different than the workshop that you have developed here. to sort of continue working on your own projects. In some ways, you know, I read about the school and also the sort of like, you know, you employ 9 people here currently and you do seem to have multiple people helping you execute your projects.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of vein, but those are actually, it's sort of like there are 2 different goals with those. The workshop versus the school. The school is more about apprenticeship and training students as opposed to executing your projects.
Well, I do have something to say about, I guess, what you're calling the workshop. Well, I began to employ help almost from the very beginning. And I thought when I went out, first I just had students who worked part-time and maybe full-time over the summer. That's the way I began. And that didn't quite do it. And so then I Richard Newman was my first full-time employee, and he was very good. But mostly what he did was prepare the wood and sand. And I did most of the carving and shaping. And then, you know, pretty soon I had 2 employees, and pretty soon I had 3. And then a big skip up to the time that I joined the Peter Joseph Gallery in the early 90s, late 80s, I guess, early 90s. And he really pushed me to make more work, because he was furnishing himself 2 houses, and he also wanted to sort of own a lot of my work. So he pushed me to hire more people and do more work. Well, maybe I should back up and go one dealer before Peter Joseph first and talk about Alexander Millikan first before I get to Peter Joseph. When I got the dealer, Alexander Millikan, he was a good dealer and a really nice guy, wonderful person. But he was kind of had a little different idea about things. The first things that I showed with him were the Trompe l'Oeil pieces, and he did sell them all. But then, as I told you, I didn't want to keep going with that. So then he came in and started talking to me about stuff. And it was a period that maybe this was a bit more prevalent, where sort of extraordinarily high levels of workmanship and extraordinarily high quality materials seemed to mean an awful lot to him. And he felt that that was a real audience for this. So at that point, I had sort of left over from, this is after the school, some of the most talented students coming through the school ended up working for me. And some of them were talented in different ways. I had one employee who was just very talented mechanically. Like, mechanically, he could, like, make anything. He'd make a clock. And another employee could just cut perfect dovetails. So really would kind of suggest maybe I should make some chests of drawers. And things like this were happening. And so, you know, we did make some chests of drawers with incredible drawers. And I had a whole series of clocks with crazy mechanisms that they worked in odd ways. And I could go on with that. But you get the idea. Then I used the talents of the people who were available to me. But then sometime later, I began to think, this was a really bad idea. I shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. I should only be doing things that I could do. What would I want to do? Well, I don't want to go on a lathe and make cogs and wheels to make a clock. I don't want to do that. I don't want to cut dovetail joints, make a little drawer now and then maybe, but certainly not. I didn't want to get involved in that. And so the more I thought about it, I really ought to be doing what I can do best.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sent me right back to where I started when I had to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
I had to plane the boards. I would have to clamp them together. I would carve. I would sand. I could do all that. So that's what I should be doing. So that's what I did.
When you look back at those periods where you were working with a diversity of skills, do you see those works as, do you talk about those works publicly as more than you? You know, we're talking about it in that sort of way right now, but do you talk about it in this sort of collaborative sense? Or?
Well, I have, or I don't talk about it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I mean, I skip it. If I'm asked to go give a lecture, and I am frequently, I have something that I have planned, and I present that, and I show pictures of my work. But I don't try to do anything historical, or I don't try to show them in any order. I show pieces that I like, and it will be heavy with recent pieces. And I won't I don't think I would. The last time I showed slides, and I don't show, didn't show any clocks, not a one. I don't really care about clocks anymore. And at one point, I think people thought I cared a lot about clocks.
It's true, you know, when you look at, you know, you in many ways within a, I don't know, art historical context, we look to define artists by what they produce. You know, we look to their art to try and figure out who they are. And so, and you know, that's a huge misconception with you in some ways, where there are all sorts of avenues that, yeah, these blind alleys that you went down mm-hmm. and then came back from, and actually you might be somewhere else while everybody's looking over here for you, you know?
That's, yeah, so, yeah, you know, that's both bad and good.
Yeah.
I think it's good from the standpoint that I'm open to try new things, and I'm not in any rut. But then it's bad because some of these don't work out so well, mm-hmm. and they exist.
Mm-hmm. But nothing, you know, do you think that these challenge, you know, these different blind alleys you've gone down and come back from, would you change them if you could? You know, would you, if you could not have made the clock series or the trompe l'oeil?
Well, they've all benefited me in some way.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I'm getting criticized for that all that much. And so it's not in the end, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
And if I'd realized what I think is the real me at some earlier point, then I might have gotten tired of the real me and gone down some other blind alley anyway.
Yeah.
So you might as well get it over with.
That's a really wonderful perspective. I wanted to ask you a few questions about form and function in your work, which always seems to have sort of this tension between it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I like ambiguity, but I make chairs for the most part. These chairs are the most interesting thing to make. And the part of the chair where you sit, there's a somewhat limited number of things that you can do without sort of ruining it. You know, too high, too low, not deep enough, too deep, back the wrong angle, so etc. So I try to actually make an ergonomically correct seat. And I don't think that's a deterrent. And I think that's good. You see so many of these design as art things that are pretty unsuitable. What I'm interested in is the fact that, you know, that you probably, if somebody had this in their living room, the chances are it's not going to be up against a wall. In the back, you might not even recognize that as a chair.
Mm-hmm.
If you walk into the room and that's your first view, I don't think right off you'd know what you're looking at. So I still have all these opportunities, and you know, you can even get big, which we're trying to do now. We've got one of those models down there that would be 10 feet tall. But the chair is going to sit just fine. And I sort of stick with that. You know, a table, if it's a dining table, it ought to be the correct height for a dining table. And there's still plenty left to do to make it interesting. So the function to me certainly doesn't come first. Form does not follow function, not by any means. In fact, it's as far away from the overall form, it'd be very far away from function. But that part of it where you actually use it, that is going to fit.
And certainly you always have the molar chair and everything. You've always come back to making chairs, but you've made other sort of playfully functional art objects as well, both with like the lamp series that you did and even the What Pluck show at the Castellani a number of years ago with these big forms with tiny little drawers. But maybe you identify this as a blind alley, but is there anything you could say about the painting series you made that doubled as tables? Because I find that so, so playful.
Well, yeah, I guess it was playful. I mean, it was a kind of an interesting idea that you could hang a table up on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom of the table would be a painting. And the legs would be stored or become some appear to be sculptural elements. I mean, I got very excited about that at it for a time.
Mm-hmm.
But it really isn't a very practical idea and really wasn't that much interest in it. I mean, it's more of a clever thing.
And very conceptual. Yeah.
Clever things are really not good.
Did you see that when you were creating it? Were you intending to try and subvert the line between art and
Yeah.
Function.
But then probably I'm not that good a painter either, so.
It's right. Nobody could see it when it was a tube.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to say about that, but it, you know, it was exciting for a moment that maybe this was a way. But, you know, if you look at the thing from the standpoint of wanting to have it be considered important, and I think the way you consider it, the way you might count whether it is important or not, is where it's exhibited and who buys it and where do they put it. Well, chairs are going to succeed there. I mean, there are chair collectors. I've never heard of a cabinet collector. I've never heard of a table collector. But I know of several chair collectors who have hundreds of chairs. And chairs just get more attention. They're just, people are more interested in chairs. And I also think you can do more with a chair than you can anything else. So it's the perfect thing to make.
You talked about how you attended the University of Kansas for industrial design. You also had desires to be a sculptor and a painter. What inspired you to want to be an artist?
Well, it's always sort of difficult for me to talk about that. Yeah, I really have trouble. I mean, I never had any art as a child. There were no art teachers in my grade school, no art teacher in my junior high, and no art in my high school. However, in junior high, in Coffeyville, Kansas, in the seventh grade boys had to take some shop classes. They had to take a metalworking class, an electric class, and a woodworking class, which was kind of unusual for seventh grade. And the metalworking class was pretty dumb, just bent metal and cut metal. And electric class, you wound up copper wire and made electric motor. That was kind of stupid. The woodworking class, you actually got to make a piece of furniture. And no one at that point considered that a seventh grader could design a piece of furniture, so you were supposed to go to find a picture of one you wanted to make and bring it in, and the teacher would help you make it. Well, I did rather well, but that's my only shop class. I never had another one. And so I never thought about that of being any importance. So I had no shop classes of importance. I had no drawing art classes of any importance. So when I went off to college, I was just sort of sent off to college. Almost everybody in my family had gone to college, so I had to go to college. So my parents sent me to a school which I had no interest in, but they thought it would be right for me, a Methodist college, where supposedly it wouldn't get in trouble, and which I disliked a lot. And really, just I didn't have a major. I was just sort of doing general studies, I guess you'd call it. But the second year in that school, I had a chance to take an elective, and I chose art. They didn't have a major in art. They just had a couple of electives. And so it was pretty much random. I mean, if they had an archery class, I might have preferred that. I don't know. You know, so it was just sort of a random event that I took art. And I did well.
I just wanted to touch on, you know, you've had a very long and illustrious career, and I just wanted to ask if you have any advice for emerging artists. You know, at the Birchfield, we've been developing a relationship with Jesse Walp, who is a local sculptor and furniture maker himself, who in many ways I see similarities because he's also working with how to distort that line between art and furniture in some ways. But for young artists who are maybe coming out of their own MFA and BFA programs, do you have any advice for emerging artists?
It's a really tough road. It's so hard to find places to exhibit and to find, you know, figure out a way to make a living out of it. At the time I came out of school, it was a very different situation. That if you had a master's degree, getting a college teaching job, there were plenty of them around. It wasn't hard. That was the normal thing that almost everybody did. And that would support your art. Well, those jobs are not available anymore.
No, not at all.
So that's not an option. I mean, a few. And I'm thinking of someone I know who worked for me briefly. And, you know, there are ways to get into the teaching program. You take any teaching job. If it's in Timbuktu, teaching people with no talent at all, and no real art programs of any consequence, and find your way to work to a better one and a better one. Once you got a job, it's easier to get another job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's possible, but that's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
To try to make a living off of work is almost means that you're going to compromise your work because you need to sell it. And the only way to make good work is to not need to sell it. If you need to sell it, you're going to compromise it every time, I think. You're going to make something that you think people want, or that you let people tell you what they want. And that's a bad situation.
How have you navigated that?
Well, I had the teaching job. I mean, I really intended to give up teaching. Well, I'd said to myself that if I can make the same or more money selling my furniture, then I'll quit teaching. But when that point came, I decided, well, I just better hire another assistant and keep that teaching job. And I'm still teaching, not very much, just a little bit. But back to your question, I think that young sculptor furniture makers, and I think they're pretty much the same. I don't think the sculptors have any real advantage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as difficult
mm-hmm.
as the furniture making. But, you know, get them into exhibits, juried. You may have to show in a gallery that's not very prestigious. You may not get much for your work. You can't necessarily get out of it what you put in it. Just promote every way you can. I have no terrific answer for that one.
That's okay.
And I tell the students the same thing, but there are opportunities, but they're more commercial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, designing a product,
mm-hmm.
for example, that would have a market and make multiples of. And that, you know, there's a whole big scene in Brooklyn
mm-hmm.
of people doing this, that they'll have a small line of furniture
mm-hmm.
and sell it. Places like ICFF perhaps get picked up by a store, which I know somebody just got picked up by a store who's been struggling.
Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude our interview?
Well, one of the things that, and I did mention this more or less today, that the importance of taking a risk. And I've kind of equated that to what it might be like to be a race car driver, a person really taking a risk. And if they don't take a risk, they're not going to win.
And you've certainly taken risks at every step of your career. You know, one of the most exciting things I think about your work is your curiosity and your acceptance and almost seeking challenges and seeking ways to change your direction, you know, at different scopes.
Yeah. I mean, and that's an odd one to seek to change direction, because I actually don't do that. It just happened. That whether I get bored, and it happens, or whether it just happens,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to say. I mean, it happens all the time, but I don't, you know, if someone were to ask, you know, that, you know, you're going to have an, I will have another one-man show in New York and if someone were to say, well, what are you going to show? I don't know. It'll be an extension of something I'm already doing. At some point, it changes. I mean, even just within a vocabulary, that the earlier ones of these were more rounded, later ones have gotten more pointy.
Mm-hmm.
Just some little changes like that.
But it does change the form, or it changes the weight of it so
and
much.
And whether you have, well, when you stretch them out, they're different than when they're short.
Yeah.
Just those little bitty things like that.
So, Wendell, I want to thank you again so much for taking the time to talk with us for the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, and we look forward to seeing your upcoming exhibitions in the next year or two. Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.